Be precise in your words. Be as honest as you're capable of. Speak your truth whenever at all possible. These are simple ideas, simple rules, but judging by political pundits who are attempting to limit freedom for the good of society, they're not simple to follow principles when it comes to facing the issues that face us in the here and now. Meaningless fear-mongering. It's the backbone of media messaging in the past, present, and most likely in the future when it comes to discussion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and property. Right now, turning on the television, you're going to be bombarded with the idea that school shootings are happening every month, every week, every day, every hour, and every minute. And that a police state needs to be formed to cuddle our children and remove guns from peaceful Americans in order to prevent complete and utter carnage. Just turn on the television and you hear grossly ignorant politicians who have no idea what they're talking about begging to take away a right. Now, the people who aren't calling for our guns to be taken away may be arguing for sticking veterans or policemen in every classroom, never mind the fact that school shootings aren't on a dramatic rise, that schools aren't war zones, and that there's no evidence that such draconian measures do anything to protect kids, but just to create tyrannical situations. Look, honestly, with the fact that schools are already prisons, it's a shock that there aren't more school shootings right now. If you treat children like prisoners, maybe they'll start acting like prisoners. But school shootings really are an insignificant factor in what is objectively the most evil aspect of modern-day parenting, modern-day childhood in America today, namely public schools themselves. Public school institutions, at least the new ones, are actually being built by the same people who build prisons. And there are 8 million. 8 million children right now on psychotropic meds for reasons only that they're not doing well in demonstrably dictatorial and disastrous institutions that children are being forced to spend tens of thousands of hours in. Now, I've done numbers of episodes. There's tons of hours in the Think About Now RSS feed where I discuss the destructive institution known as public education and how destructive it is for the mind, body, and soul of children in America and how we got there. But today, I want to have a conversation about a man who's attempting to help young men and women find a sense of meaning in their life. A meaning that they're attempting to find after thousands of hours of meaningless education and having a meaningless existence. Because right now, meaning is being stripped away from children, from men, from women, from everyone else by this civilized, castrated modernity. That man is Jordan Peterson, and he is a man who is empowering people. Now, empowerment is a bit of a buzzword, but just because it's used by self-help gurus doesn't mean it's not beneficial. Peterson, and this is not a knock, is a self-help mentor to many men and women in our society right now, and people are flocking to him. He's presenting tools by which people can create order in their life. How people choose to interpret his works is more about them than it does about Peterson. And that's true of any intellectual who chooses to speak up about the ails of modern society. There's a huge benefit to people who believe in the importance of the individual and disavow collectivistic, oppressive narratives. There's a benefit to pushing a belief in extreme self-ownership. It's easy to make fun of what seems like simple ideas regarding simply getting your shit together. I know people in my own life who've benefited from his work. I know I personally have. And when I think of all the aimless men I know in my life, who I've met in my life, who I've lost in my life, things like drug addiction and suicide. Well, anyone who's out there who's genuinely helping out people propel themselves out of states of pure, utter desperation and depression, I'm pretty damn enthusiastic about them. So today I'm going to have friend of the show, David Gornosky, on, who was recently able to speak to Jordan Peterson in New York. David was good enough to join me in a discussion regarding Peterson's work and more broadly what it is that's waking up so many people to, honestly, such old wisdom that Peterson is bringing up today. Enjoy the show. How did you go about getting the interview with Jordan Peterson?
Oh, and you know, it's just in time with his book. My wife and I flew out to New York City and she helped me with the video, and we were able to actually interview him basically the day of his book premiere in America. It went really well. It was our discussion, and we got to kind of get into the weeds of some of where I'm coming from and how it correlates with where he's coming from. So he's a machine, man. He's all over the place interviewing, you know, in all kinds of different countries. He had just gotten back from, I think it was Copenhagen, the day before that he talked to me in New York. But yeah, he's certainly a fellow traveler with a lot of the things that you and I agree with.
Yeah. So what do you think it is that people are so attracted to when it comes to his message?
Well, I think it's people are tired of the kind of, I like the way he puts it, that we've been sold this banal package of rights-based discussion, and there's not enough talk about self-responsibility and getting yourself sorted out, like he likes to say. I think that resonates with a lot of people. The millennial generation particularly has a lot of listlessness to it. There's a lot of kind of apathy and complacency that's really hard baked into our generations thus far. And I think a lot of that has to do with the merit badge way that we were often brought up in the millennial generation. And there's a sense of like, well, wait a second, I need to have something that I can, you know, kind of measure myself past, present, and future by in terms of self-improvement, in terms of responsibility, self-sacrifice. And Jordan's the only guy really on the mainstream talking about that. And it's a powerful message. It's been around for a while. You know, if you get into Carl Jung, his psychology, it really is where a lot of Peterson's work comes from, as well as evolutionary psychology continues to kind of break apart the pretty little white lies of the social justice movement that dominates the media landscape. So I think those two packages, the Jungian stuff that really resonates with people looking for a sense of responsibility in their life, and then the refusal to go along with the social justice language police that evolutionary psychology gives him the ability to do. I think those two combos make that little combo there makes a really powerful punch for his message.
Absolutely. So obviously, you know, he's channeling a lot of Jungian archetype. Do you also believe that there's also, he's coming in kind of the legacy of Joseph Campbell?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think he's in that wheelhouse as well.
Okay.
And for those, you know, Campbell basically was taking Jung's work and just taking it and trying to make it more popular. You know, he was popularizing Jung's psychology, and he was doing more of a focus on how that relates to the hero's quest. But, I mean, Jung did that too. Yeah, you know, Campbell was more of, I guess he was again, just the best way to put it is he's a popularizer for some of the stuff that Jung was getting into with mythology. He took it and expanded it further. In a popular sense, you know. I mean, he did academic work as well, but, you know, he was kind of he was one of those rare, you know, those public intellectuals like, you know, like you would say, like Christopher Hitchens or some Richard Dawkins type.
Yeah. And obviously, as part of the issue with discussing Campbell's work, honestly, for me, is there's obviously gross generalizations that come into it. Not only people trying to dilute Campbell's work, but by Campbell himself, and then people trying to stretch certain ideas. For instance, the idea that all of the different types of mythologies all have the exact same similarities between them. I mean, I'm sure you've seen where, you know, some atheists try to state, for instance, that, you know, Dionysus was also born on December 25th and that he rose from the dead, and the same thing happened with Hercules and all these other supposed gods of the past. And a lot of that is actually just simply not true with many of those stories. But to be able to, you know, I think what is tying together many of these ideas regarding the hero's mythos is delivering oneself from chaos to order as a product of constant vigor, right? Because the hero's journey is not a hedonistic and meaningless one, but rather the catapulting of virtue onto the world through actions that undermine short-term pleasure for long-term success. And I'd say that a lot of Peterson's message is one kind of against blanket hedonism and more towards, you know, long-term thinking and about making the world a little bit of a better place.
Right. And then since that market is not being fulfilled, he's got a wide open opportunity to create a kind of a monopoly in some sense, right? In a good sense. And that's what he's done. I think we just need to take the energy that he's opened up in that space and expand it in all the different directions and angles that we can go with, because it's been a much needed conversation in our culture. You were mentioning the archetypes. I think the archetypes, they have their place, but ultimately, you know, the core of his message that I think resonates the most is you know, that long-term view. In biblical terms, we would use the word cultivation, maybe, you know, the idea of cultivating life rather than consuming life. The idea that we have so much of an incentive in our economy to have a high time preference. And that's an economic way of looking at what Peterson's talking about. And what that simply means is that we tend to burn resources quick for short-term gain, short-term pleasure, without thinking of a long-term investment strategy for the things we want and the satisfactions and the desires that we'd like to pursue. So when we have that long-term perspective, it makes all the world of difference in terms of allowing us to kind of pace ourselves, to discipline ourselves, and ultimately to kind of master our desires so we're not totally a slave to them. And that's what I think is important because, you know, as libertarian type people, we get real into liberty, but really liberty is not just the absence of external coercion, but it's also the ability to master the internal desires that inflame our hearts.
So when we're discussing the idea of rights-based discussions rather than responsibility-based discussions, which you alluded to earlier, I think that's really important because constantly in conversations that I've had, especially on deep philosophical ideas, people say, well, I have a right to say this, or I have a right to believe that, or that person has a right to believe such and such. And that's never what I'm contesting, right? I'm never contesting the idea that a human being is capable of believing in contradictory concepts, merely that maybe if one is trying to seek towards the truth, right, or the idea that there is a truth, then a conversation should occur and that rights really play no part in this, right? The the philosophy is what you should do or what you ought to do, not what you should be forced to do, right?
Yeah, I agree. That's why, you know, those of us who are in the liberty movement or are interested in political discussions or economics, it would be very well for us to think of aesthetics and to think of anthropology. That's the problem with the liberty movement is that they kind of start in this kind of vacuum where we just pop up out of the primordial goo of superstition and fantasy land in the ancient world. We just pop out of the Enlightenment with a little fully autonomous little, you know, like brains on sticks walking around. And it's like, no, that's not really how we got there. And so there's no real proper anthropology that's really grounding a lot of the libertarian discussions. And so when you don't have that anthropology, you have these weird mixed up thinkings where you talk about, well, it's my right to act like a jerk or do this really offensive behavior. It's like, well, yeah, sure, like on a legal standpoint, but who defines their entire existence based on what is the ethical role of government? I mean, that's not at all the fullness of what it means to be living in a, you know, human life is not about just that factor, although it's extremely important. But yeah, you're right on that. We need an aesthetic. So we need to know what's beautiful, not just what's legally okay for a state to do. We need to know what is actually beautiful for me once I have my freedom. What is the most beautiful exercise of that freedom and of my abilities, my virtue? What is the most beautiful thing that is absolutely stunning in terms of it capturing what it means to be a human, which I think is that self-sacrificial love that's at the heart of like the Christ archetype that Peterson touches on so much.
Yeah, and it's very easy to kind of undermine specific points that he brings up regarding self-help, right? So let me just bring up real quick his book, right, where he's discussing, you know, these are the 12 rules, right, for living a better life, right? Stand up straight with your shoulders back. Treat yourself like someone you are responsible for helping, right? Make friends with people who want the best for you. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is. Now, that's 4 out of the 12. Now, those are pretty basic, right? But in actuality, you know, and if you compare that to, say, a lot of other self-help material that's been presented over the years, that's not even contradicting any of those and is, in fact, in agreement with it. And so someone can point up the criticism, well, he's just regurgitating other stuff. Well, first off, he kind of admits that, you know, these are basic ideas that have existed throughout thousands of years. That's his whole point. And secondly, he's bringing it to an audience of people who don't normally read self-help kind of information, right? Who are too afraid to bring up these ideas. And including to people who are too afraid to, say, look into cognitive behavioral therapy and the importance of it, right? I went to this thing about 2 years ago It's called the Landmark Forum, kind of a self-help, you know, mentorship type of program that they were offering. And I immediately jumped to criticizing it, saying, hey, this is just bastardized cognitive behavioral therapy mixed with, you know, product salesmanship. And then I saw so many people become kind of happier and better and have a deep therapeutic response to it. And then I had to look at myself and go, hey, you know, not everyone is going to get to enlightenment or a better state of being the same way you did and take the exact same steps. We should just be kind of happy that people are willing to take those steps right now at any point in their own life. So to undermine the work by saying, well, that's not how I would deliver it. Well, that's such a weak point of criticism. Or to say that, you know, that there are better ways. Well, better ways for whom? Right?
Yeah, that just, you know, Peterson, like I said, his work is mostly, you know, he's taking two key pillars. Of course, he puts a lot of great work in, you know, in drawing empirical data and his clinical studies to underpin what his wisdom he shares. Peterson is he's pulling from his clinical research. He's pulling from a lot of good empirical data that Jung didn't have at the time. And then he's pulling from evolutionary psychology. So you've got, those are the pillars of his research. Carl Jung's psychological, analytical psychology, evolutionary psychology, and then the empirical data and clinical research that he's done as a psychologist. You put that combo together, that's a really potent combination of a toolkit. And then the key is his personal story. It's his charisma, which is the missing X factor, which can take, you know, someone who has his own little idiosyncrasies and so forth, and all of a sudden he's turned into this rock star because his charisma, which is kind of that intangible, hard to define energy that just, it seems like his full body is resonating with the truth that he speaks. When you find leaders like that, people don't care whether they get the full message, you know, 100% just like to their liking. They're like, this guy believes it. I feel it. It resonates magnetically with me when I listen to him speak. And so, yeah, that's kind of the package for success in this.
Yeah. And what's also interesting is kind of how clean his background is. I know that sounds odd, but in today's society, the first thing you do when someone is speaking out the truth or speaking out lies, doesn't matter which one, you always go to their bio and then try to dig something up to find something they did bad, say 30 years ago, and then use that against them. And honestly, if we look at, you know, philosophers of the past, that would have been incredibly damaging and no one would have been able to do anything. I mean, Martin Luther King visited, you know, he visited white prostitutes and was a terrible husband. Malcolm X was a horrific husband who beat his wife. Mahatma Gandhi slept with 14-year-old girls, although may have not had sex with them, but we do know he laid naked in bed with them. He stated horrifically racist things towards black people. We can go even to specific artists, people like Picasso. The majority of his wives actually killed themselves.
Jesus turned water into wine when he was a young man.
Yes, totally getting sloshed up there. So he's in a position where you can't, at least it seems, I believe, you know, if there were some stuff in his past that journalists could have dug up, they would have already done it, you know.
But his whole rise to notoriety was based on his thought crime of not going along with the transgender speech law in Canada, where they were saying it would be considered a hate speech to not use the preferred gender pronoun of whoever you're speaking to, and whether it's them or Z or Zer or Zler. He was saying that the idea that the law could, you know, command me to utter a speech in language that's not even in the English language is so reprehensible that he had to speak out against it. And of course, to you and I, we're like, oh, that's not that controversial. But to people in Canada and stuff, you know, and people in a lot of urban centers in America, that's extremely, you know, scandalous. So he kind of emerged from scandal in the mainstream. Of course, he had all that work on YouTube prior that was already just sitting there, but that's really what kind of shot him up. And so maybe the fact that he grew out of a scandal gave him kind of a Teflon power to be able to keep weathering future scandals. And that's something we actually got into with my interview with him, where I was like, you're actually channeling the nonviolent power that Jesus demonstrated in his own life, because you're turning the other cheek. You're not resisting the violent aggression that comes towards you when the crowds try to shut you up or stop you from speaking. You never return it. Usually you don't return it with the same vitriol back at them. And I said, every time you do that, the evil collapses on its own weight and you get more and more support. And so you're channeling into what the gospels call the logos, which is the power of Christ in you, manifesting itself in the ability to stop evil without returning evil for evil.
Absolutely. And I find it, you know, there are things about Peterson which hit me not in the best way when I first heard about him. I mean, partly it was the Christianity, although he changed my mind about some aspects of that. And then partly it was also the discussion of, he kind of just lumps together cultural Marxism, the Frankfurt School, and postmodernism, which are contradictory ideas and don't exactly all piece together as a nice conspiracy. But that's such a small aspect of the overall message that he's given that, you know, I think it's kind of fine.
Yeah, well, actually, but there is a connection I'm kind of with you on there in one part, because I do think there needs to be more careful consideration for the totality of postmodern thought. I think there are great postmodern insights that we can, you know, be a part of and assimilate into our understanding. But there is some correlation between the some postmodern thinkers and the rise of what is popularly called in conservative circles cultural Marxism, in that the French invasion that took place like in the 60s and 70s and everything in America. The thinker that I actually integrate into some of my research a lot, René Girard, he was a teacher at Johns Hopkins University in the 1960s, and he actually was the one that accidentally, so to speak, brought the French invasion of like Lacan and all those different people into the U.S. academic scene, because he put together a conference where he invited a lot of French scholars to engage with him, and he was not one of them. Girard would be more of a structuralist, so he's not a post-structuralist like the guys that we're criticizing or Peterson criticizes. But they did really have some interest in kind of a deconstruction of you know, what they would call patriarchy, and they would tie that into capitalism and all those other things. So there is a little bit of a connection there, but it does need to be parsed out more.
Yeah, I mean, well, Foucault, for instance, whenever he spoke of oppression, he didn't state it as diametrically two different things. Like, he wasn't like all black people being oppressed by all white people, but rather he spoke of it as oppression is going both ways, right? And that there's not a clear delineation between the oppressed and the oppressor, which is necessarily diametrically opposed to, say, the social justice warrior thing, where you basically have the oppression Olympics, right? And And Jordan Peterson's parsing of past writings and his way of cutting together and putting different ideas together, and his discussion of, say, the approximations of truth rather than truth itself existing, are actually kind of postmodernist in that it views the world through gradations rather than black and white.
Yeah, I think there is that connection. But, you know, I think, you know, a lot of times it's, you know, Foucault is writing in a way that is, you can take it in many different ways. It's kind of obtuse sometimes, a little bit like a puzzle. You have to crack what he's trying to get at. And there's a specialist lingo to some of the writings in that space. And a lot of his, and like what happens is a lot of the fangirls and fanboys that came around Foucault and these others, when they invaded the American academic scene, they took it and they integrated it into, you know, their already latent Marxist sympathies and kind of repackaged it. Because remember that classical you know, modernist Marxist thought kind of took a big hit around the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and there needed to be kind of a way to capture the zeitgeist of the victims' revolution in a new way. And so they certainly integrated the postmodern obsession with language, which there is something to that, right? There is something that I think we need to respect about language is a way of constructing reality, but the way The problem I have fundamentally with the postmodernist critical theorists that we have in academia today, and I engaged them when I was in college, is they assume that power is the ultimate good in and of itself, that you just take power and they're like a, they remind me of like a dog chasing a mailman in a car. What are you going to do once you get there? You know, I'm always asked those professors when I went to school back in those days, and I would say, so what happens once you overthrow the patriarchy and overthrow white supremacy and all this stuff? What do you do then? Like, what do you do when you've got the power? Are you going to get back at your opponents? And they never really know what to say because really, if all you care about is power, the only way to keep it going is to keep inflicting pain and suffering onto your opponents, which creates them, which just creates the same victim cycle over and over again, you know?
The very statement that power is the ultimate good is itself contradictory to postmodernist ideas. I mean, Foucault said where there is power, there is resistance. So I would definitely state, though, that the power as a good is very much a product of those who wanted power, though, who want to be able to use power and the manipulation of words to be able to justify it. But the blanket bastardization and reinterpretation of Foucault's work, I mean, that's kind of expected, no matter who is talking in any given moment, who speaks with any kind of power. I mean, you've found Marxists who do this with the quotes of Jesus, but I would still state right now that I couldn't interpret the work of New Testament as an argument for Stalinistic rise of a government, right?
You could, or you're saying you would not?
I would not.
Yeah, no.
You bastardize one quote about give unto Caesar, and then it's just like, yep, therefore we should have a socialist state. It doesn't quite work.
Sure. What do you think of critical theory, though? You know, the idea that everything is about, that they're all about deconstructing the power centers of society, and that's what's popular today, like in language arts and, liberal arts colleges and things. It's all about, I mean, I studied communication theory. So first we start off with Marshall McLuhan, and we looked at, you know, the medium as the message, but it wasn't long before every class that you would ever take would always go back to trying to find this critical theory where you're looking for latent white supremacy in a Chrysler ad, you know, and they would talk about, well, Beyonce is performing as the acceptable black figure because she has white features, and so the racist power structure will only show people like Beyonce as black female role models because they have white features in them. And they were talking about how that's some kind of a, you know, hegemonic conspiracy and all that. I mean, that's what critical theory is. I mean, called conspiracy, but I'm just, you know.
Yeah, so in their cases, though, in the cases of critical theory and cultural Marxism, they are looking through a lens that is absolute to be able to find what they find to be truth and true oppression, while postmodernist critical theory are situating themselves within historical and cultural contexts in order to be able to better interpret data by looking at it through the relative lens of what was going on at the time, but not making normative claims about what is and what is not. So I think the importance there is the separation between determining what is and what should be and the prescription of it. So, you know, when I look at critical theorists, and, you know, when I went to school for, I was a sociology major back in my day, you know, it was fascinating to me how much anything could be interpreted as a result of corporatist capitalism that is degrading society. But it was almost as Michael Malice calls progressivism, Christianity without an ethos, or Christianity without a divine figure. They put things in a specific type of hierarchy that necessarily needs a domineering godlike figure. And in their case, they're talking, of course, about using the state to be able to enact whatever actions they find necessary to justify. But again, I would still delineate or separate that from, say, postmodernist like Foucault. Now, of course, the problem is that the term postmodernist can mean anything past the modern normative lens, and that itself can result in the bastardization of the philosophy so easily. And I would, and honestly, I'm fine with that criticism as a whole, that maybe it was too waxing and waning and not absolutist enough in the way by which it was described coherently in the beginning, and that academia itself has bastardized it. But I would say that necessarily the way that academia is set up, especially in the terms and the way we have it right now, which is, you know, basically the state overrunning people's lives, that it was that any type of philosophy was going to be that would get placed in academia was going to lend itself to justifying the continuation of its own existence, right? So the interpretation ended up having to become Marxist, because the university system itself is one that is kind of lends itself towards Marxism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, the way I boil it down for the average person who's like, I can't follow all these different debates and all this stuff, I just say there's an overarching hegemonic force, and that just means a power structure which kind of rules in an unseen sense, and it infects everything. It's like the fish bowl water of our fish bowl. You know, we're in the fish tank, we're fish, and if you ask someone, how's the water, you know, if you're another fish, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. And that's the way a cultural hegemony works. It's the subconscious kind of aesthetic that's built into presuppositions for how we view the way the world is. And in that sense, the overarching totalitarian culture that we need to be on guard against, and I think Peterson is an ally on this, is what I call victimism, which is the attempt to use concern for victims, the real concern for victims that we all have in different ways, as a means of gaining status and power, and absolute power at that. And so that's the really the linchpin that really drives so much of what the madness that we see in the West, where it's like you have to self-flagellate your own culture or the past supposed winners, so to speak, of your own culture in order to get ahead or to gain power in a social culture. This is not an aesthetic that we should accept. It's actually, to dovetail to what you were saying a while ago with Michael Malice, it's actually what René Girard would call super Christianity. It's a violent totalitarian form of Christianity which takes out the grace, the forgiveness, the personal responsibility, and just says there have been people who have been sacrificed, whether it's a racial victim, gender, poverty, sexual orientation, anybody or disabled, overweight, anything that ever was a disadvantage in the classical Western society or beyond or before, all of those people are given, you know, protected status in a way in which you have to use violence against anybody who are not in those categories. And this is really a destructive thing, because the first thing they take out is free speech. The next thing they take out is your right to self-defense. And without those two things, there's no freedom at all. There's no way to do anything. So that's the most important thing we need to be on guard against, I think, and Peterson's right to be fighting it.
Yes. And those two points, actually, those really come down to freedom of association, right? And how integrally important it is that we have that kind of freedom of association. The very fact that people conflate his statements about being against the law, which states you have to speak a specific way, right? Conflating that with the idea that he's against free speech is insane, but also conflating it with the idea that therefore he is being bigoted against a specific group is also absurd. In the same way that I believe I should be allowed to give money to people who are less fortunate than me, but I'm also against me being forced to have my money taken away from me and given to someone else, right? The violent redistribution of wealth, right? The problem is that the moment that force is added into it, it goes from being a charitable, voluntary, good-willed action into a one that necessarily involves the use of violence, which takes away all of the goodwill and positive aspect of it, right? Therefore, everyone ends up becoming a slave to a specific system rather than voluntarily giving to different groups and intersects of human beings and taking away any sense of true peace or volition within a given society.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Christianity is ultimately about, which is the aesthetic that the victimist totalitarians are imitating, but bastardizing at the same time. And that is, Christianity gives a choice. Okay, it's about self-sacrifice or keep doing the way you always did. That's all it's about. Jesus doesn't give you an ideology that says you must keep up, you must submit to my master plan. He just says, You can die, take up your cross or not. I mean, in the sense that with Christianity, you have this radical opportunity for personhood to emerge against the collective. And I think we are indebted to the aesthetic of Christianity and the ethical framework of Christianity that the highest good, the highest social position, which, you know, in the biblical text is the place of God, right? The place of God is found outside our camps, outside the privileged temple walls, which in our day and age, the city center would be, you know, our biggest buildings, not the temple. So we're outside of the halls of power. God is found abandoned, naked, alone, tortured, brutalized, hanging from a cross of disrepute, abandoned by everyone, including his own followers who write the eyewitness accounts about what happened, and he's rejected by everyone. And that Christian aesthetic is that person and not the collective in its power structures, that person is where God stands. And that's where we have the beginning of personhood emerging in our aesthetic and in our concern for, wait a second, let's not throw off the disabled off cliffs like they used to do in the ancient world before this story came about of Christ. You know, in the old days, if you had a handicapped child, they would throw them off the cliff, you know, and they wouldn't even think a thing about it. And today, you wouldn't do that. In fact, and today, in the West, the best seats in the house are for those who are handicapped. So if you go to a theater, you know, the best seats in the house is the place in the theater where Caesar would have sat if you were back, you know, thousands of years ago in the ancient times. Now we give that to the person who is the most physically handicapped. Now, of course, that's the power of an aesthetic that takes care of the weak and takes care of the individual against the collective. It's not perfect. Of course, we're working it out. That's why it's a choice. It's not an ideology that you just brainwash into. It's something you have to work out as an individual every day with your own responsibility, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's a beautiful explanation of how actually empathetic and positive certain aspects of our society are, and how much we've went from treating the disabled with a sense of privilege rather than wanting to, say, sterilize them and throw them off of cliffs.
You know, but what victimism does is it takes that beautiful process that we're coming to grips with in society, especially in the West, but now globally with the West infecting everywhere around the globe through globalism, global trade, global media, global social media, and all that. There's the victimism takes that real beautiful concern for victims, and then it just sneakily, just like a satanic thing, and I don't mean that like it doesn't have to be religious, just in the sense of the original word for Satan, which means accuser. It takes it and it twists it back into something bad. Like, for example, I saw today someone showed me a report from a lady who was talking about how George Washington's teeth were not wooden, but they were, she made the case that they were probably pulled from the teeth of slaves. Now that's good to know. It's good to know that, you know, these icons of American nationalist myth were not as perfect as we were growing up to learn them to be. You know, when we were in public school and stuff, you don't hear about that. And so there is a good, healthy deconstruction process if that's true, I don't know, you know, but that the lady was making the case that this is an example of how black bodies have been used by sick George Washington. And, you know, he may have done that and it may be sick, but she made it as an argument against, you know, why white people have been doing this to blacks. Like, and I thought to myself, okay, that's true. Everything you're saying is true. But I mean, in 1979, the Central Africa Republic his name is Basso, I think, was the dictator of that. He was eating his opponents in 1979. I mean, there's evidence that he was cannibalizing his opponents and sending some of them into to be eaten alive by animals. Now, this is an African person in Africa. So the idea that you can put the line between good and evil as white people are evil and then all these other races are benevolent and innocent, it's bullshit, you know? And the idea of castigating George Washington as a symbol of why whites are the pernicious evil of society, that doesn't do anything for the guy being thrown into an animal cage and eaten alive by this dictator in Africa. At that point, he doesn't care about what white supremacy garbage George Washington was doing. He cares about what all humans should care about, which is you don't treat your neighbor in a violent way. And so victimism totally rejects the universal need to see evil as possible in all of us. And that power differentials And the use of coercion to get your way is always wrong. And that's the root of all human problems, you know? And so they're trying to destroy everything that we've built in the West. And we've got to speak out against it, you know, kindly but forcefully, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, David, are there any other thoughts that that you'd like to share in regards to not only your interview with Jordan Peterson, but just, you know, this great, I'd say, philosophical revolution that is underway right now?
Well, I think it's one of the most interesting times I've seen is emerging here, because we have people with Trump. People, thankfully, Trump has really helped people wake up to the barbarous nature of the state, the fact that it keeps doing what it does, regardless of who you elect. And this opportunity allows people to say, okay, well, where are we? We're not just blank, you know, left and right anymore. There's this new kind of coalition of people saying, what does it really mean to be an American? And what does it mean to be a someone of the West? And ultimately, what does it mean to be human? And so these big questions that can be answered and talked about, it's a wonderful opportunity. Peterson's a part of it. There's other people. Dave Rubin's a good one. You know, Ron Paul's still out there, and the allies that he has, they're still doing the good work on the political side. But all of this is one package, right? Which is that the human person does not deserve to be treated in a violent way. That's just a basic concept, right? And you start there from your collective ethic, and then the personal ethic is, okay, now self-sacrifice. Don't abuse your freedom. Because every time in history, we've had these totalitarian laws that force good behavior, right? Nanny state stuff, all these regulations. It's always been because people abused some kind of freedom. And so what we have to do is get our freedoms back and then cultivate a culture in our own life that other people want to imitate, that they find contagious, that is self-sacrificing. So what that means is that get rid of the bad laws that create totalitarianism. But at the same time, use your speech to love people and not castigate people or discriminate people. And use your, if you have a business, use your business to generously give to those around you, instead of having laws come up that, you know, force us to give. So it's up to us. Really, we have the opportunity to make this thing, or really see sayonara for the next few hundred years if we don't get it right now.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, man. Where should people find most of your work?
Well, my main website is aneighborschoice.com. I'm also actively posting on Facebook. And then my writing is at the Daily Caller, Town Hall, the American Conservative, Fee.org, Lou Rockwell, any of those sites that you guys like. I kind of tend to put my articles out on all those different platforms on a regular basis. So you can also see my YouTube channel, David Gronowski. Search for that, subscribe, where you can see my interviews with Peterson and Michael Schumer. Shermer is coming out soon. So a lot of great content on there as well. So thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for being on the show. Years, days, makes no difference to me, babe. You look exactly